Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2011. Lecture 1, delivered on August 22nd, 2011. The title of this lecture is Introduction to the Discipline.
Today, Introduction to Finance. Contrary to some textbooks, and I won't mention any by name, although yours says it, contrary to what textbooks say, finance really doesn't have anything to do with accounting. This book, in fact, says that financial management, finance, is a cross between accounting and economics. And just in technically speaking, when that kind of an idea is what we call bullshit. Finance is a subdiscipline of economics. Finance is the economics of value. You need to know economic terminology to be able to do finance, not just as a student, but to also think in financial terms, to be a financial analyst, to be a financially oriented individual. However, it is useful for me that you hear and see accounting being described as a core of finance. Here's the deal. In economics, we assume that all people are rational. All institutions are rational. All organizations are rational. Now, you might say, well, that's kind of a broad assumption because I've met some pretty stupid mofos in my life. Yes, I have too. You go on YouTube, they have something called failblog.org, where you can see people trying to remove themselves from the gene pool, usually to some greater degree of success, depending upon how they land on a pole. But that doesn't mean that they're irrational. Rationality is bounded for both the individual and for the firm. We don't have all of the information in the world. We just don't. Information is limited. Information is costly. So we cannot make the optimal decision. We just can't because we don't have all the information that would be necessary for the optimal decision. We hope that as we get older, more information is available to us from our past experiences and from other people getting creamed. But also, there are other binders on rationality. Money is a binder. You don't have all the money in the world, so the best decision is just not going to be there for you, simply because you just can't afford what would be the best that would keep you alive the longest, make you the healthiest, make you the happiest, and all of that. Other binders are, here's one that is absolutely critical. I'm going to tell you something really kind of depressing. I have to tell it up here. Woman, you are going to die someday. You know what? It will hurt like hell. It usually does. People are, they're dying, they bitch, they moan, and thank God they finally shut up and die. So, you see, that's going to put a real limit on your activities. I saw a gravestone. The gravestone said, well, this sucks. Literally. That sums it up. This sucks. I had things to do, and I can't get them done now. But that's a limit on your total amount of available time. You die. But there are even shorter limits on your time. One of the strongest of them is your circadian cycle, the cycle of the day. There are only so many things that you can get done in a day. And whenever you choose to do one thing, you're probably not going to be able to do other things, notwithstanding this multitasking crap. Multitasking usually means driving and texting at the same time, which usually leads to squealing tires and people bitching because someone got hit and got killed. So you see, there is a limit on our time just by the day, by the cycle of the week, in college, by the cycle of the semester, in business, by the cycles of the projects and the deadlines. We have these limiters on our best. We can't do our best because we just don't have the time to do our best. Let me ask you this. Son, have you ever had sex?
Yes.
Okay, we're good. You have a choice of studying for my final or actually being able to have your loin work. You can't do both. You dream on, Sparky. You are not that athletic looking. You got to make a choice. This leads us in economics to a concept called opportunity cost. Opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. Opportunity cost is the cost of the best foregone alternative. Every time you make a decision, you give up something. This is something that accounting cannot take into account. That doesn't mean accounting is flawed in some way. They have to have a receipt. But you see, every time you do one thing, you are surrendering other things. When you are in this classroom sitting here, you could actually be out, you could have a job. $7 an hour. You could have a job, but you're in here. So the cost of your tuition, the money cost, that is only a small part, because every hour you're in class, you should be studying at least 2 hours out of class. Some of you are saying, yeah, right. Every hour in class, 2 hours out of class. So that's 3 hours. So you've got your 3 hours. Well, actually, this class is almost an hour and a half. So that's 3 hours a week plus twice that much. That's nine. So 12 hours a week just on this course. And you multiply that by a total of in-class contact time, 18 weeks. What the hell is that? That's like, I so suck at arithmetic. It's a lot of money, but it's not. Yes, I am a finance person and I suck at arithmetic. But it's not something that is on an accounting statement anywhere. It's not money that went out of your pocket. It just never came into your pocket. And that means that there is this hidden, indirect cost that is in many cases the largest cost that is incurred in any project you take on. What you give up costs far more than what you pay out. And that's one of the realities of a college education, is that it is an extremely expensive endeavor. That's why you don't see lots of people doing this, and especially older people who are more into their stream of higher income. You don't see a lot of wealthy older people sitting in this classroom. The same is true. Have you ever? Okay, think about this. Let me give it to you this way. We have different stores in this town. It's a surprising number of grocery stores. Everything from Aldi's, I don't shop it, I hate Aldi. They put your damn food on the floor and they make you pay 25 cent rental for your cart. Okay, we'll go to Walmart on the low end, and then you go up to the high end to stores around here like Schnucks and Fresh Market. Great stores. Pretty much the same stuff you can get at Schnucks, you can get at Walmart. But you pay much more at Schnucks and Walmart for that stuff. How could those stores possibly survive charging more for what they are selling? It just doesn't seem to make rational sense, but it does, and it is a very compelling story. Think about this. You've got two people who are working. One of them, you work at State Barn for $50 an hour. You work at McDonald's. No, you don't. You don't look like a McDonald's person. Yeah. Okay, Wendy's for $8 an hour. You can go in to Schnucks, and pretty much there are not a whole lot of people in there. You can get your stuff and go right up to the line and buy your groceries and be out of there. But let's talk about what happens at Walmart. And I'm speaking here because I'm a Walmart slut. I go. The first thing you have to do is find parking. You will park way away, and then as you're trying to walk through the parking lot, you'll have some son of a bitch try to run you over with his truck, which has a bumper sticker on the back that says, "My wife, yes, my dog, maybe, my gun, never." You get into the store, and the first thing you hear is a voice underneath you, "Hi, welcome to Walmart." Oh, God, they're hiring dwarves for greeters. You go through the aisles. There is a cow in the middle. "Honey, what do you want for dinner?" "Get out of the way, cow." You finally find some approximation of what you want, meat, and they put quotation marks around it, possibly Man of War or something like that. And then you go up to the line, which is snaking back. Sure enough, right in front of you is a cart full of kids. One of the kids is sticking his nose in his finger in his nose, looking at you. Up at the front of the line, Granny is trying to use a debit card for the first time. "Now, that was 12 times. It still isn't working. Granny, hurry up. Go home, eat. You're going to die." You spend an extra 30 minutes at Walmart just on the aggravation. An extra 30 minutes that you wouldn't spend at Schnucks. That's a half an hour. For a person who is working at $8 an hour, that's a $4 amount of opportunity cost. But for a person working at $50 an hour, that is $25. Literally. That's why you will see people who are well-to-do sort out and go to the high-priced places. The same is true at places like Disney World. Did you know that if you have enough money, you can buy a pass that will get you to the front of the line of those roller coasters and all of that? Otherwise, you stand there in line for 3 hours baking in the sun like this. You ever notice that rich people don't stand in long lines for rock concerts? Years ago, I couldn't believe it. I actually agreed to allow my daughter to go to one of those boy band things. It was in town. I can't remember the group. It started with an H. Hanson. Yes. Hanson. I mean, literally, when I went to the venue, the line was 30 blocks long, little teeny boppers bouncing up and down. Eee! Their dads were just dropping them off. "Bye, don't let old men be weird with you." Here's the deal. You see this all over the world, all over the place, everywhere. Opportunity cost is there. It drives decision making. And if you ignore it, which has to be the case in accounting, they have to, because there's no physical receipt, there's no documentation of it. But if you ignore it in finance, you will make bad decisions. One of my favorite examples was I was teaching at another university here in town. It was a stuck-up place, but I won't mention its name. Illinois Wesleyan. And we had the mayor of the town at the time, Judy. Her dream, her legacy was to have a giant coliseum built here. And so she was going to speak to all of the business students, especially my finance students, a lot of them. And so we brought them all in, and this mayor of the town wanted to tell her dream of what she was doing. And she brought her financial management expert with her. She brought him on a chain. "Come, boy, come, come, sit, sit." And she had him explain financial analysis. And he went through this whole thing of, well, here are the costs of construction, here are the costs of the equipment that we will have to use for this, the cost of the workers, and obviously it's a positive net present value project. In other words, this is obviously a go. Well, one of the things, of course, that they assumed was that they would be able to draw people to this Colosseum from 60 miles around. Who am I kidding? This is normal Illinois. From 60 miles around. Yeah, sure, you're going to compete with the venue in Peoria, but that was the best one. And at the end of his lecture, he looks around, are there any questions? Well, my students were very polite. They were good, good kids, and they didn't say anything. But I could tell that there were a couple who actually, there was something bothering them. So I held up my hand, and I said, where's the cost of the land? Oh, well, we own the land. Oh, you own the land. So you don't have to consider that as a cost of the project. That poor son of a bitch looked like he was going to shit. Because he knew very well that that was a cost of the project. Because when you use that land for that project, it is no longer available for rental, for sale, for anything else. It is actually a cost of the project. When you pull a person off one project and put that person onto another project, that person becomes a cost to you because you have given up that person in the next best alternative use. Every time we make a decision, even if it's for something that we already own, it's a cost. Your car, every day that you drive a car that you own, it is a cost to you. You don't notice it because, for example, the car that, do you own a car? It sucks. It's ugly. So you don't really notice it. But what happens if on eBay that car suddenly becomes worth a $500,000? Are you going to be emotionally attached to that car, or are you going to sell that mofo? You are going to sell it. Suddenly, it is, every day you drive it, that's $500,000 you don't have in your pocket. It's actually still a couple of $100 you don't have in your pocket now, but the benefit is above the cost, so you just don't recognize it. You just don't act on it. But you see, everything that you own, that you use for one thing, is a cost to everything else. And that is a crucial cost in finance. Now, here's another thing, a distinction between finance and accounting. Accounting deals in historical cost. It has to. That's just the way it is. Now, we use accounting data, but we have to recognize the decisions are not made on history. They're made on expectations of the future. We use historical data as a thinly veiled reflection of the future, but that gets more and more perilous the closer and closer you get to the world of investments, because a stock price has nothing to do with the past of that stock price. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the past of that stock price. And to some extent, one extent or another, everything that we do in finance has to be based upon expectations of the future, not on what has happened in the past. Again, we use accounting data, especially for financial analysis of companies. We have to be cautious, though, because we cannot assume that the future is going to be like the past. Let me give you an example, just a random example of why the past is not what matters. It's your expectation of the future. Someday, son, you are going to be married. I know, but it will happen. Eyesight isn't great in every girl. You are going to be married. You have 30 beautiful years. Every evening you come home, the house is well lit. There is this loved one of yours waiting for you to tell you about her day. You tell her about yours, and the two of you laugh and have a good time. One night, though, completely weird, you open the door and it's dark. Hello? And all of a sudden, she comes out from around the corner with a submachine gun, dressed in leather, with a tattoo of Johnny Depp on her shoulder. You think, uh-oh. She starts firing the weapon. Boom, 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 boom. You barely dive out the door, and as the bullets are flying, you scramble to your car. You get in your car, and you finally escape as bullets are hailing, or a hail of bullets is following you. You drive around for a while. the rain starts. The music is playing on the radio. Oh my God, it's your song with her. You are so beautiful to me. A tear comes in your eye. A little voice says, go back. Are you going to go back?
No.
Hell no! Your decision about what to do next is not going to be driven by the average history of 30 years. I mean, she fired 18 bullets. Over 30 years, that's not a lot of bullets a year. But you see, you're driven by the margin, the last action. That drives your, you are not going to base your next decision upon history. You're going to base it upon what happens next. This bites with teeth in economics and in finance. Let me tell you how much it bites in business. Suppose that you, I'm trying to think here. I've looked around this room. I'm trying to get to recognize faces. I'll know you all by the end here. Let me look at you. You, son. You have gotten your degree here at this fine university, being taught by the greatest professor that ever walked the earth. Recommendations from everyone from Muhammad to Jesus himself. And you will decide you're going to live your dream. You're going to run your own little gas station. You change your name to Al. You get yourself one of those shirts with the little circle that says Al. You buy some pants that when you squat, your crack shows. And you buy a little tiny kiosk gas station, and you start into business. I just felt cool air come right there. Is that me just dying, or is it actually cool air conditioning working? Okay. You have your Coca-Lean truck come in, sell you 50,000 gallons at $3.25 per gallon. You put the competitors around you, you and they all do about the same thing. Well, they collude. They all look and call each other. Of course they do. That's not collusion. That's perfect competition. And you mark it up 25 cents, so you charge $3.50 a gallon. You pay the driver, and he pulls out. You have a few minutes, there's no one around, so you go back into your little station and you sit down on your sad little chair to watch your sad little black and white TV. And somehow, between the time when you left and when you came back, a world crisis had happened. NATO attacks Iran. Iran mines the Strait of Hormuz. Silkworm missiles have already brought down one supertanker, and rumors are that an American aircraft carrier has been dropped in the Persian Gulf. Tehran is on fire. There is a report of a mushroom cloud. And there are attacks being reported in various cities like Riyadh and Amman, and Tel Aviv is under fire from Scud B missiles. What do you suppose is going to happen to the price of gasoline on the high seas? Yeah, that doesn't take rocket science. Yes, it's going to go through the roof. You are so relieved because you know that the price of gasoline has shot to $9.75 per gallon off the truck pipe. But you got yours at $3.25. Oh, the relief. So you go back outside. And you look at all of your competitors. What? All of my competitors are now suddenly changing their prices on their signs to $10 a gallon for gas. You think to yourself, those greedy sons of bitches. They got theirs at $3.25 just like I did. I'm going to be the right guy. Are you intelligent, still charging $3.50 for your gasoline? If not, why not? Who's right in this? Those other greedy greedy gas stations that got theirs at the same price you did and then just popped theirs up to $10? Or are you right to do it with the based upon the cost of your gasoline? Who's right? Come on, come on, come on. Why? No, it's not hard to get. It's the point there. You're on the right track. It is the replacement cost. You sell your gas at $3.50 a gallon. You know what? You don't have enough money to buy the next load of gas. You just don't have it. Now, all those customers, oh, I love my customers. My customers love you. They will wipe out your gas, and then they won't remember your name was Al. They will drive right to the $10 gas. They'll bitch about it, and they will pay it after they have destroyed you because you wanted to do the right thing. It has nothing to do with historical cost. It has to do with expectation of replacement cost. We still fight that. This is a debate that's been going on for centuries. It was actually a religious debate between two monastic orders, the Dominicans and the Franciscans. Thomas Aquinas said, prices, there are natural prices that are linked intimately to cost. And the other side, led by Roger Bacon, said, no, there's no relationship between price and cost. There is no natural price. It's whatever is driving. He didn't use the word supply and demand, but that's exactly what he was talking about. He was the one who was right. But we still get stuck in this mentality that somehow cost has something, historical cost has something to do with price. It doesn't. Not a thing to do with the price you charge. The price you charge is the price you charge based upon what you expect to happen next. I'm a professional photographer. It costs me maybe, 50 cents to produce a beautiful photograph. I charge anywhere from $99 to $400 for my photographs. That's nothing to do with cost. It's whatever the market can bear. So that's a fundamental distinction we have. We have to look at expectations of the future. Accounting doesn't have to do that. We do. And in business, your expectations, if you are well-trained, you're thinking properly, your expectations are going to be much more likely to lead you to good decision-making than if you just base things on what history has told you and all of that and what the costs have been up to this point. By the way, these are economics concepts. You should have been taught this in some way, shape, or form in economics. Were you? Good. This doesn't mean that I'm trying to turn you into cold-hearted sons of bitches. Well, yes, I am, but that's beside the point. I can't protect you, but I can prepare you. And I'll do a damn good job of it so that when you do things and when you do the right thing, you do the right thing for the right reason. Driving your company out of business because you wanted to do the right thing by your customers, that's not right for your customers because you can do a lot more for them in the long run by staying in business than you can by going out of business. And you can do a lot more for them by being right by yourself than you can by simply handing over the bank to them and so they won't criticize you for being greedy. And I want to make a point here about that, about greed. And these are kind of harsh points. And you can choose to buy into what I'm saying or you can choose not to. It has to do with your culture, your upbringing, your religious convictions to some extent, and also to other matters. But here's the thing. This is a capitalist economy. Notwithstanding these idiotic teabaggers, oh, socialism, oh, like hell. We're a capitalist economy, market-driven. That does not mean we're perfect. One of the worst things that can happen to a good market economy is when excess market power gets concentrated, which has happened terribly in our economy. Everything from Microsoft and Google to the oil companies and a lot of other information technology and service providers, they do a disservice to the strength of a really efficient market. That off to the side, that notwithstanding, let me give you an example of what I am trying to get at in this little piece right here. I'm setting up the framework of your thinking here. You are a bread maker. You make bread. You're the only bread maker in town. Pretty much you can charge whatever you feel like charging to the extent that the customers can pay it with their incomes. You have no incentive to do things efficiently. When you put the flour into the bowls, flour falls all over. You hire your lazy-ass loser brother who basically plays World of Warcraft all night when he's not surfing for porn. But it's okay because you can charge whatever you want for your bread. You're a monopoly. You can do whatever the hell you want. Now, here's the way the world works. Have you ever seen people who have more money than they deserve? I have met many of those people in my life. You are ugly. Why do you have a good-looking wife? Ah, that's right, you're rich. Yeah, Tiger Woods, homely as hell. Sure, Nordic blondes are going to go after that. Just yesterday, I had a beautiful Nordic blonde say, I want to have your babies. No, it doesn't happen. I've seen rich kids who are dumb as bricks, but they have everything. I want to take it away from those little twerps. And in a capitalist economy, I can. You see, because if there is truly no limit on what you can do with your private property, if the government stays out of your way, someone out there, you possibly, are going to be greedy enough to say, now wait a minute, all I have to do is not make a mess with the resources. I don't have to hire some lazy ass brother, and so I can charge less for my bread. I can do that. And I can take his business away from him. Using resources more efficiently is called static efficiency. Using existing resources more efficiently is called static efficiency. You can simply beat him out in business with static efficiency, and you have an incentive to do it. You know what that incentive is? Money. You don't have to love your customers. You don't have to care a rat's ass about your customers. We say that all the time. We are in business to make our customers happy and healthy, to make Mother Earth a good place to live, and to have bunnies jump around in fields. Like hell, we're in business to make a profit. Really. You are doing it because you want to drive him out of business. And as long as you can do what you want with your private property, you can engage in static efficiencies because he was too lazy to. And you're doing it because you want his money. But then something else comes up. You can do one better. You can rearrange factors of production. It is amazing how human history has worked. Have you ever wondered, how the hell did they figure out to make a match? Or how did they figure out to do this or that? Technology is nothing but rearranging factors of production. They have lied to you about this. So they talk about technology as if it has to do with computers. Technology in the classroom. Technology in your home. Technology in your ass. No! Technology is not about computers. It is a hallmark of the hubris of those computer jerks that they think that technology is theirs. Technology is merely how you arrange the factors of production. You can figure out something, a new machine. Use more workers, use fewer machines. Use more machines, use fewer workers. Try this with your equity. See if you can borrow more money and use less investor capital. Rearrange the factors of production some way so that you can make the product at a lower cost. And again, you're doing this not because you love your customers and you want them to have a great deal. No, you are doing it to break his back. That's the only reason you're doing it. Technological change to increase efficiency is called dynamic efficiency. Dynamic efficiency. First comes the static efficiency, using the existing resources as efficiently as possible. And then comes dynamic efficiency, innovating technology to use the resources even more efficiently. And again, you are not doing this because you love your customers. You are doing this so that you can drive him out of business, send him into bankruptcy, and make their kids have to go to Illinois State University. Oh, God, I'm podcasting this. You see, this is why we innovate. This is why we do things more efficiently, why we use our resources more efficiently, why we think of new technologies. The human genius comes into action because we are greedy. You know what this means? Greed is not bad. Greed is good. Greed works. Greed propels us from one generation to the next to use our resources more efficiently. Instead of talking about, well, we've got to live with less and turn off our lights more, let's innovate. Let's drive this economy upward. Instead of trying to live with less, let us live with more. But it all hinges on us being able to use our private property in our own way. If you want to waste your resources, throw away what you've got, by all means, go for it. Join the masses of the self-pitying emos. Did you hear about there's a new emo pizza? Yeah, it cuts itself. Sorry. Sorry. The hell was I? But you understand there's something in this process that's even more interesting. Imagine, now you run the business, the bread. You are the bread man. You put up a sign, my bread tastes like ass. No one's going to buy your ass bread. Mother takes her boy in there, no, mommy, I don't want any of that bread. That bread tastes like ass. Oh, shut up. There are kids starving in China who'd love to have an ass sandwich. Got someone up there, what's wrong with an ass sandwich once in a while? You can't sell ass bread unless you're good at niche marketing. Look, you can't make a bad product and expect that people will buy it because he'll come back around and kick your ass if you do that. As long as he is allowed to let his greed drive him, if you start selling butt bread, he will simply find a way to point out to everyone, you know what, you eat that guy's bread, you will have ass breath. You see, this is a self-propelling system, but it is driven by greed, it is driven by rationality, it is driven by expectations of the future. It is not driven by the past, and it is also driven by conflict. The great Prussian professor Georg Hegel said, history is not about conflict, history is conflict. That's why we are in business. That's why I'm preparing you, why all the professors here are preparing you for the future. That's why we are in the top 100 business schools, so that we can give you the best there is, so that you can go out there and not put your head down, but bring your head up and put your fangs out and be your best, because that's how we can fix this mess that we have allowed to happen in this country. Now, finance has three primary branches in it. First is financial management. Financial management is the internal analysis of projects, the cost of them, the viability of them, and the means to finance those projects. Cost, viability, and means. That's financial management. Now, we focus a lot on financial management in this class, but I take you into the other areas as well. The second large area of finance is investments. Those are external opportunities to increase wealth through providing capital to business entities. To increase wealth by providing capital to business entities. The third area of finance is financial institutions. The financial intermediaries. Now this, I explain it like this. The world can be separated into two groups, but they are not mutually exclusive, and I'll have to get into that in a minute. But there are surplus economic units, and there are deficit economic units. In other words, there are economic units, people, companies, other types of institutions that have money, and then those are surplus economic units. And then there are people, institutions, companies that need money. Financial intermediation is the matching of the surplus economic units with the deficit economic units. It's the matching of the surplus economic units with the deficit economic units. But that matching has three dimensions to it. First of all, there is level. How much? And then there is timing. When and how does money return? And then there is the risk. Now this gets into the weird, well, it's not weird, but it's kind of odd, and I don't see a lot of addressing of this. You can be a surplus unit and a deficit unit at the same time. Look, for example, in my pocket right now, I've got, whoa, Denny's tonight, sweet. There are the white, I mean, why don't they have White Castles in this town? Okay. I got money right now, but I want to buy a new car. I don't have the money for that. So if you were to come up to me and say, can I borrow $50? I'd say, oh, hell no. No, I would. I might lend you some money. I would be a surplus unit matched to a deficit unit. The levels would be the same there. However, I can also be a deficit unit, and no one in this room could work with me. Even if you were a surplus unit, you don't have the kind of money that would be necessary to lend me for a new car. So you can have that kind of weird thing. A lot of people, they will borrow money, but they have a huge amount of money that they probably don't even think too much about. As you are going through your working career, you're putting money into some kind of a retirement. It might be Social Security, in which case, you know, good luck. No, but you could have a 401k or something like that. So your money is acting in a pool as a surplus economic unit that can be matched in terms of level with the huge needs of corporations that need giant capital projects done. So in that regard, you're a surplus unit, but at the same time, you might need the money to borrow to get a surgery done, so or something like that, or to put your kid through college or something like that. So you can be surplus and deficit at the same time. Now, again, level has to do with how much. The financial intermediaries have to match, okay, you've got this much money, that matches how much this unit needs over here, level. Timing, okay, when do you want, you're the surplus unit, when do you want your money back? Well, I want it back within a year. Okay, you're the deficit unit, how do you want to pay the money back? Well, I want to pay it back in installments over 20 years. Okay, no match there. We've got to find the match. So that's what I mean by timing, so that both the surplus and the deficit units have the same expectations with regard to the return flow. And by the way, note this. It's kind of a minor, but it's a subtle point. Financial intermediation isn't just moving the money from the surplus units to the deficit units. It's also the return trip, setting up the mechanisms and the facilities so that the funds can come back the other way. It's not just one way. It has to be both ways. Okay? Now, risk. Risk, there are some investors who are very risk averse. That, when I say investors, I don't mean just people, but people are part of it too. And then there are other risk investors. They love risk. They will buy risk. They are the ones in the evil term speculators in futures markets and other derivatives markets. They are the ones who are taking risks off the shoulders of those who don't want them. So risk has a lot to do with this. So for example, when you are younger, you're willing to roll the dice on investments that are on the riskier side. You're willing to throw a couple hundred dollars into a crazy stock deal, possibly. But when you get to be like 60 years old, you're not going to be throwing money like that. You want what's called fixed income investments. You want to be pretty darn sure you get that money back. And obviously, you're going to expect to get a lower return for it because there's more certainty of it. But there are different risk clientels out there. And so the financial intermediation process, crucially, critically, must be able to bring the units that are appropriately matched in terms of risk together. Because you don't want to put companies or individuals in a position where they are at much greater risk than they want to be. This was one of the great disasters of the credit derivative swaps market, was that a lot of honest to God, good, decent people and trust funds and companies believed that they were investing in low-risk securities. And what they did had no idea was that they were actually being hooked into massively risky credit derivative markets. There's nothing wrong with those kinds of risks. Hell, I write the options. I teach the advanced finance course where I teach you how to calculate the prices of those things. But at the same time, when you hand to a trust fund that is going to provide money to kids, to old people, you hand them investments that have risks that are just staggering, they're not ready for those risks. Not only are they not wanting those risks, they do not have the facilities and the instruments around those risks that mitigate those risks, like the heavy-duty risk investors do, the speculators. That's the danger in this kind of risk thing, is always be careful. I am amazed to this day at how many people think that they buy, for example, certificates of deposit, and those are low-risk securities. Hell no. You could very well be playing in markets of derivatives and not even know it. So this is something that is crucially important in financial intermediation. And it's a place where not only do we have to have better regulation, and I'm not a big fan of government regulation, except when you're talking about robbing kids and old people of money, and you're talking about messes that are actually killing our government in terms of how much they're costing. But you're also talking, let me not get into that. It pisses me off. Let me give you an idea. We did a bailout of the securities business, the mortgage business. It was to the tune of about $1 trillion. The problem is over, right? Those credit derivative swaps, those toxic instruments, we got all that cleaned up. No, we didn't. You know how much of that toxic waste is still out there spinning around places, hiding in investments, in seed, long-term CDs, in investments that people and institutions and countries don't know they have? You know what the value of that mess, that toxic waste is out there that we haven't cleaned up, that no one talks about? Try a notional value, our best estimate, $63 trillion. That's right. More than the entire wealth of the entire planet by a good factor. So this is a crucial role of financial intermediaries in the future, is not just level, not just timing, but grasping crucially what is actually the structure of the investment, the risk structure. Is the investor appropriate to the investment? What is the surplus unit buying, and what is the deficit unit selling? Making it clear and keeping people away and institutions away from these dangerous instruments if they are not highly, highly sophisticated and know what they're doing. But that's the story of the three aspects of financial intermediation: are the level, the timing, and the risk. And as we go through this course, this is basically what we're going to be looking at, is finding what the value is based upon levels of cash flows, timing of cash flows, and the risk of the cash flows. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.